Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Over the weekend, an investigation from the New York Times provided new insight into China's mass detention of as many as a million Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other ethnic minorities in the western region of Xinjiang. An anonymous member of the Chinese political establishment leaked more than 400 pages of documents to the Times, including internal speeches from President Xi Jinping, that shed light on the origins and execution of China's growing network of internment camps. It's one of the most significant leaks in decades from the notoriously secretive Chinese government. And here to tell us about it is Austin Ramsey, Hong Kong correspondent for The New York Times and one of the journalists behind this new reporting. Austin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
You received hundreds of pages of documents that shed light on China's detention of minority groups in Xinjiang. What did we learn that was new here?
I think one of the most significant things about the documents is that it shows the gap between the way these camps are portrayed to the public, to the rest of the world by the Chinese government, and the way the authorities discuss the camps among themselves. And there's a pretty stark difference. The government describes these camps as sort of a mild education programs where people go to learn Chinese language and learn about the law and learn job skills that will help them improve their lives. But what they describe, the way they describe them in the documents are forms of punishment. And it becomes very clear when you see the documents that the authorities are quite aware of how this program affects families, takes parents away from children, leaves people without bodies to plant crops or to earn money, and causes quite a lot of devastation to families that have people in the camps.
Do we know how many people are being detained and what are the conditions of their detainment?
We don't know the exact number of people who are in the camps. There are no numbers in these documents, and it appears to be one of the more closely guarded secrets in these camps. There have been estimates of a million or more based on things like satellite photos and Tinder documents for the construction of camps and things like that. And there have been a range of scholars who have come up with these estimates. The conditions, there have been a few sort of visits for journalists, and they sort of see a model camp that seems almost like a sort of boarding school or something like that. But we have interviewed people that have described very difficult conditions where they might not have enough food or might have food withheld for punishment, or they might be beaten, particularly in the first periods that they're in the camps. And people describe them as very difficult places to spend long periods of time.
What do we know about the person or people who leaked these documents?
The documents were leaked by a member of the Chinese political establishment who wanted the leadership to be held accountable for the decisions made in terms of these programs. And that was one of the most interesting things to us. In addition to that person, the documents themselves also describe a couple of officials who were punished for not fully executing the detention program. There was one official who had 20,000 people put in camps and then let 7,000 of them out sort of on his own. And these officials aren't sort of human rights champions by any means. These are local Xinjiang officials who have been carrying out crackdowns throughout their career. But they seem to feel that this particular crackdown went too far, would exacerbate tensions in the long run, and would prevent them from reaching their economic targets that they needed to get promotions elsewhere.
Your reporting also found that President Xi looked to the United States post 9/11 policies when shaping some of these, his government's approaches to the Uyghur population. Help us understand that connection.
He described that sort of in terms of the way after 9/11 that the population in the U.S. sort of mobilized to monitor things that were happening around them. And he used the term from Chinese history of people's war, this idea of like organizing the population to carry something out. And he said, you know, we should be good at this sort of organizing the populace. And it's a way of sort of everybody watching each other, I think, was sort of how he was describing it. And that's what he was looking for, sort of a higher vigilance of neighbors watching neighbors to look for anything suspicious.
Austin, do we know whether or not the United States government has had a chance to look at this? I'm sure they are aware of the existence of these camps, but has there been any movement from the federal government here on how or whether to intervene?
I know there's been some discussion and criticism from the U.S. State Department and several congressmen, congresswomen, presidential candidates. There's also been discussion of using Magnitsky Act powers to punish officials, to target officials who are directly involved in these camps. But to my knowledge, I don't think there's been any action taken yet on that front.
Has the Chinese government responded to what you published in the New York Times?
They have. Initially, the first response came from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they did not challenge the authenticity of the documents, but they said that we sort of misinterpreted the camps and what they're meant to do and the conditions in them. Later, the Xinjiang regional government and also some Chinese ambassador in the UK did describe this as fake news and also said that we misinterpreted the camps.
Austin, do we know whether or not there have been any deaths so far in these camps? And if there have, are those numbers increasing?
We know anecdotally that there are deaths in the camps. We hear from people who have family members there, particularly members of the Uyghur and Kazakh exile communities abroad, who have reported about deaths of family members. But it's very hard to say if those numbers are going up or down or even what they are. I think it's important to point out that from everything we know, these don't appear to be death camps. That's not the purpose here. That it's not meant to wipe out a population. But it does seem that there may be instances where people have not received maybe the medical treatment they need or the sort of harshness of these conditions on an older person could exacerbate conditions that they already have, things like that. So it is possible that there is a higher death rate, but we just don't know.
Austin Ramsey is the Hong Kong correspondent for the New York Times. Austin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we're going to switch gears and talk about the response from the international community, including the United States. With me now is Louis Charbonneau, United Nations Director at Human Rights Watch. Thanks for joining us, Louis.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard a pretty intense report from the New York Times based on hundreds of pages of leaked documents regarding these camps. What has been the international reaction to these conditions so far?
What we've seen in recent months has been a kind of escalation of outrage, I would say, and revulsion about the information that's been coming out. We've been doing a lot of research at Human Rights Watch on these detention centers, so-called re-education or vocational training camps. And I think that initially there was a lot of skepticism about whether the claims were true. I mean, to say that over a million Turkic Muslims have been detained in camps, which some people liken them to concentration camps, it's a bit hard to believe in the 21st century, but the fact is that there's more and more information that these are not some wild claims. This is actually happening, and it's happening on a massive scale. It's a kind of extremely creepy Orwellian program that the Chinese government has undertaken to alter the identity of an entire population in Xinjiang. So now people are realizing that this is true. And what is particularly disturbing of the documents that the New York Times came up with is that this is systematic. This is something that has been planned. It's being driven at the highest levels of the Chinese government. Xi Jinping himself is pushing this, demanding no mercy. These documents weren't a surprise, but they really show that this is a plan that has been worked out in great detail, and all of the denials that the Chinese government has been putting out into the public domain in recent months are simply hard to take seriously. What we have not seen, unfortunately, from the international community is a kind of overwhelming response to pressure the Chinese government to stop this. There are a lot of countries that consider what Beijing is doing in Xinjiang to be wrong, but most of them aren't saying it.
I feel like there's a lot of talking around this and not a lot of action. And I'm curious about whether or not the United States in particular, the Trump administration, has had any specific policy towards these camps or towards its relationship with China writ large. We know that the Trump administration has been at odds with China, if you will, when it comes to trade policy. Have they said anything specific about these detention camps?
Yes, the Trump administration has actually been pretty energetic on this issue. It's one of a small number of countries that have been the most outspoken. The U.S., Germany, and Turkey, they've been pressing the United Nations to speak out about this. They've been raising the issue regularly. Of course, there's a lot of skepticism about the U.S. position on China, as you quite rightly flag. I mean, let's face it, when it comes to human rights, the Trump administration is fighting an uphill battle when it comes to credibility. They're saying the right things about the Turkic Muslims, mainly Uyghurs in Xinjiang, but this is an administration that implemented the Muslim ban. Many people have difficulty reconciling the fact that an administration that was pushing the Muslim ban is talking about this, but they are doing it. It's something that we welcome. We would like to see the Trump administration being more principled on other human rights issues, but they are saying many of the right things here.
I'm curious about whether or not that talk is extending to countries that are predominantly Muslim as well, as this is the population that's really been targeted here in China. Are we hearing anything from Muslim-majority countries?
Unfortunately, we're not hearing very much from Muslim-majority countries. What we've seen is that they've been largely silent, or even worse, the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, has actually come out and praised China for its treatment of Muslims and specifically for what it's doing in Xinjiang. Now, individual countries, when you talk with Turkish officials, for example, they say that they were extremely disappointed by the failure of Muslim countries as a group to come together to condemn what's going on in Xinjiang. But you'll notice that actually Turkey, which has been so outspoken for a very long time on this issue, they've actually toned down their criticism of China. China has threatened retaliation against the countries, economic retaliation. They have made no bones about it, particularly with Turkey. They said publicly, if you want to go on criticizing us, then you're going to pay a price, a severe price economically. I think a lot of countries have heard this and they're afraid to speak out.
Is that something that you're seeing writ large in terms of the talk or the rhetoric around the Uyghur detention camps, but not a lot of firm policy? Is the fear of economic retribution really part of what's happening here?
I don't think that the United States necessarily is being driven on this issue, but for the vast majority of countries in the world, economics play a key role in this issue and their decision to keep silent. At the same time, China is not just an economic power, it's increasingly a diplomatic power. It's a permanent member of the UN Security Council with a veto. So a lot of countries don't want to cross China. We've seen a very good example of the kind of disappointing rhetoric from the international community is the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. He has been very reluctant to speak out about this issue and We've seen the reaction of his spokesman yesterday when asked about the New York Times documents. They had a very unfortunate comment in which they said that they would like all countries to comply with human rights in the context of counterterrorism. And frankly, it would be better if they didn't say anything, because by talking about human rights in the context of counterterrorism, they're just reinforcing the Chinese narrative that this is all about fighting terrorists. It's very unfortunate that the United Nations is saying these kinds of things, but you know, the fact is the U.S. is pulling out of the United Nations, so China is increasingly playing an important role diplomatically at UN headquarters in New York. That's a fact. And so I guess that the Secretary General wants to do everything he can to avoid upsetting Beijing.
Despite the fact that these are could be considered pretty severe human rights violations. Louis, we're going to have to leave it there, but I appreciate your time. Louis Charbonneau is the United Nations Director at Human Rights Watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.